Welcome to The Science of Murder. This podcast discusses the intersection of crimes, mostly murder and serial killings, and the science that is used to catch the perpetrators. We will shine the spotlight on some of the pioneers of forensic science and techniques that were used to catch murderers. We will talk about how many notorious serial killers managed to evade being discovered, as well as how they were ultimately caught and convicted. We will also discuss times where science, or the people yielding it, failed. My name is Lissa, and I'll be your host for the discussions of the science of murder. I'm not a forensic scientist, psychologist, or legal professional. I'm just one of the many people who are interested in the topic of true crime and its perpetrators. In my daily life, I'm a medical laboratory scientist. My profession is grounded in the how and why of biological and chemical data. I'm someone who looks at a clinical result and tries to see the human story behind the numbers. That's kind of how I look at these cases. I am curiously fascinated in the how and why these crimes happen and how science has developed to catch and convict the offenders. I'm here to open up those conversation topics that still aren't quite acceptable to the mainstream, but also ground them in my own love of science, scientific techniques, and psychological studies. Today, we are discussing the science of cold cases. Sometimes cases go cold because the technology of the era has reached its ceiling. The evidence was there, but our lens wasn't powerful enough to read it. Other times, the science was perfect, but the connectivity was missing. We had a biological or mechanical signature, a DNA profile, or a ballistic mark, but it was a silent ledger with no corresponding entry in the database to give it a name. Whether it is the lack of viable leads or a lack of resolution, these cases enter a state of investigative exhaustion. They become investigative ghosts, sitting in cardboard boxes, waiting for the gap between the evidence and the answer to be bridged. The goal of investigators is to apply current scientific rigor to these stalled ledgers to see what was previously unreadable, to ensure that no boogeyman can win by simply waiting out the clock. In the professional world of science, we understand that data is either active or archived. In the context of a criminal investigation, a case doesn't become cold simply because a specific number of years have passed. Instead, we define a cold case as the moment the investigative cycle fails. This isn't necessarily a failure of effort, but a point where the process can no longer move forward. This failure usually begins with investigative exhaustion. This is the stage where every traditional filter has been used up. Every witness has been interviewed, every lead has been followed to its end, and all physical evidence has been processed with whatever tools were available at the time. When the methodology of the era can no longer generate a new data point, the active cycle reaches its limit. From exhaustion, we move into the administrative stall. This is where the investigation has hit a ceiling. Sometimes that ceiling is technical, the evidence is there, but the science isn't sensitive enough to read it. Other times, the science is perfectly capable, but the connectivity is missing. A lab might produce a flawless DNA profile or a clear ballistic signature, but there's no entry in the database to match it to. That data remains unindexed and silent. Finally, the case enters hibernation. This is the official transition from a current crime to a historical record. The file and the evidence are moved out of active rotation into long-term storage. At this point, the case is no longer part of the routine audit or a daily workflow. It stays in this static state, waiting in a property room until a new technological capability or a new hit in a database allows the audit to begin again. Cold cases serve as the ultimate test of what we can call the sanctity of accountability. In any scientific discipline, the integrity of your current work relies on the consistency of your methodology over time. If the science cannot be used to reconcile the past, it loses its standing to guarantee the integrity of the present. These cases remain important because they represent a fundamental need for historical and biological accuracy. We can view an unsolved case as a glitch in the historical record. As long as the file remains open and the perpetrator remains unidentified, a lie is being able to allowed to stand as truth. The prime example of this is the John List case, where a man was able to live under an alias for 18 years, successfully overriding his true identity in the eyes of his community. When science finally intervenes, it isn't just solving a crime, it is performing an act of historical correction, ensuring that the record reflects reality rather than a fabrication. Beyond the history, there is a psychological weight of the phantom. As long as a case is cold, the perpetrator exists in the public consciousness as a boogeyman, a figure who appears to have infinite power simply because they are unknown. Scientific rigor is what strips that power away. By applying a disciplined audit to the evidence, we replace the mythic phantom with a clinical data profile. We move the entity out of the realm of urban legend and place them exactly where they belong, in the cold, objective reality of the biological ledger. This is the ethical core of our discussion. We do not look back at old cases with pity or sentimentality. We look at them through the lens of a professional mandate. This is about the standards we set for the data we handle and the expectations we place on the systems designed to process it. We have to recognize that using the best tools currently available is not a luxury or an elective choice, it is a professional obligation. In a laboratory setting, we understand that evidence is essentially a microscopic witness. That evidence hasn't changed over the decades. It has simply been waiting for the analytical sensitivity of our technology to catch up with the story it's been holding. If we have the capability to extract more data today than we did 30 years ago, then we have a duty to perform that audit. This leads to what I call the resolution pivot. If a victim's story was originally told in standard definition back in 1974, using the limited parameters of basic blood typing or rudimentary ballistics, we now have the means to retell that story in 4K genomic resolution. Science has moved the goalpost of what is knowable. Because we have access to higher levels of precision, we are the ones responsible for advocating for that shift. It is our job to ensure the truth is told at the highest resolution possible, leaving no room for the distortions of a lower quality past. To build this architecture, we have to look at how we, as a society, perceive the passage of forensic time. We often find our anchor in media. Specifically, the blue-tinted nostalgia of shows like Cold Case, or the steady clinical narration of Forensic Files. These programs serve as a social reflection of how we view the cardboard box of truth. Take the show Cold Case as a primary example. It utilized a very specific visual language. A sepia-toned portal to bridge the gap between the present and the past. When the protagonist, Lily Rush, would pull a dusty file from storage, the screen would shift into those color-graded flashbacks. This wasn't just a stylistic choice. It mirrored how we think about memory and evidence as something buried and waiting to be uncovered. The closure hook at the end of every episode usually involved the victim appearing as a ghost to the person who solved the case. While that's purely sentimental, it speaks to a deep collective human desire to believe that justice is a form of peace for the dead. But these aren't just stories. They are a collective scream for justice. We watch these shows because, as a society, we refuse to accept the idea that a perpetrator can win simply by outlasting the system. We want to believe that the clock never actually runs out on the truth. This is where the justice thread connects back to the reality of the work. The role of the scientific process is to answer that social need for closure with objective, biological fact. We take the ghosts created by unsolved history and replace them with data that can finally stand up in a court of law. The first pillar of this architecture asks a fundamental question: does the evidence actually exist? In the context of a cold case, this is where the pursuit of justice for the individual truly starts. It involves a calculated risk. If we decide to consume the final microliter of a biological sample on a subpar or outdated test, we have effectively robbed that victim of their future chance at the truth. We have to be the stewards of that sample, ensuring it is only utilized when the technology is capable of providing a definitive answer. The second pillar is the chain of custody. This is where high-minded science meets the grueling reality of physical storage. In a cold case, the breakthrough doesn't always start at the laboratory bench. It starts in a basement or a warehouse, hunting for a mislabeled box, a misplaced logbook, or a boring glass slide that was filed away and forgotten decades ago. The issue here is clear. Justice is often buried under administrative failure. A trail goes cold not because the science failed, but because the clerical system did. A mislabeled box or a misplaced logbook from 1982. Finding that evidence isn't just fixing the filing, it is retrieving the only physical remnants of a person's story from administrative neglect. We document obsessively in the present because we understand the cost of a broken chain of custody in the past. Every scan, every signature, and every detailed entry we make today is designed to ensure the next generation of justice seekers has a clear, unbreakable map to follow. We are working to ensure that the investigators of the future never have to go on a rescue mission for the truth we are handling right now. The third pillar represents the high-resolution pivot. This pillar represents the transition to modern technology and public participation. We are no longer limited to the basic markers of the past. We are utilizing SNP profiling and next-generation sequencing to aggressively clear the investigative backlog. A major component of this is the crowdsource flex. By using voluntary databases like GED Match, we have essentially deputized millions of genetic witnesses. People who've never stepped foot in a crime lab are now providing the data points necessary to bridge gaps that have existed for decades. This brings us to a specific type of investigation, the forensic audit of a nobody. The television show The Forgotten captured this grittier reality, focusing on a network of amateur sleuths working to identify John and Jane Doe's. In the real lab, this is where the heaviest lifting occurs. We aren't just asking who killed them, With the more fundamental question, who were they? To answer this, we move into the complex science of identity, utilizing mitochondrial DNA, stable isotope analysis, and other technologies. We can track where a person grew up based on the mineral content in their teeth and techniques like forensic facial reconstruction. The professional standard here is absolute. We treat a 30-year-old DNA extract like gold because it is the only physical piece of that person's justice left on Earth. It is the final link to their identity. We use every modern tool at our disposal, from the sequencer to the global reach of the internet, to ensure the victim is no longer a Jane Doe, but a person with a family, a history, and a name. The final pillar, and the reason we do any of this, is the audit of truth. This is where the clinical process meets the finality of the historical record. When we identify a figure like the Golden State Killer or the perpetrator in the Adam Walsh case, we aren't just closing a file, we are reconciling history. We are removing the question mark that has sat over a timeline for decades. We have to accept that in cold cases, a traditional courtroom trial isn't always possible. Witnesses pass away, suspects die, and statutes of limitation can interfere. However, the laboratory still delivers the ultimate sentence, the truth. Whether or not there is a conviction, the audit provides a definitive co conclusion that stands as the final word on the matter. This brings us to the actual case files, the specific entries into the ledger where the theory of the audit meets the reality of the evidence. It's important to recognize that this is good and worthy work. Not just because of the technical challenge, but because it produces a tangible conclusion. In these files, we see the professional mandate in action, proving that the passage of time does not degrade the truth, it only waits for us to develop the tools to find it. When we successfully bridge that gap, we achieve a reconciliation of the record. We get answers and in the best case scenarios, we get justice. But even in the cases that remain in a state of hibernation, this work solves a vital purpose. It provides a blueprint. It gives us a documented reason for hope, even if the files haven't been resolved yet. Every time we apply a modern audit to an old sample, we are signaling to the future that we have not abandoned the search. We are proving that as long as the evidence exists, the case is never truly closed. It's simply waiting for us to turn on the light in the laboratory. These cases are the evidence that the truth is persistent, and our dedication to finding it must be equally unwavering. The John List case serves as the definitive bridge between the era of vanishing and the era of forensic persistence. It's a masterclass in how a perpetrator can meticulously manipulate the administrative and environmental ledger only to be dismantled by the combined forces of anthropological aging and psychological profiling. This was not a case solved by a lucky break. It was solved because the investigation transitioned into a high-resolution audit that refused to let a phantom stand as the final record. On November 9, 1971, John List methodically executed his wife, mother, and three children in their Westfield, New Jersey mansion. The scene was characterized by what investigators call a clinical silence. This was a result of List's extensive pre-planning designed to delay discovery and sanitize his identity. List used environmental manipulation to buy himself time. He lowered the thermostat in the mansion to approximately 10 degrees Celsius, 50 degrees Fahrenheit. In a laboratory context, we understand that this was an attempt to inhibit bacterial putrefaction. By artificially cooling the environment, he successfully slowed the postmortem interval markers, allowing the bodies to remain undiscovered for 29 days without the typical olfactory indicators of decay alerting the neighbors. Simultaneously, he executed a total administrative erasure. He canceled mail, milk, and newspaper deliveries, informed the children's schools that they would be visiting a sick relative. Most significantly, he engaged in visual sanitization. List physically cut his own image out of every known family photograph in the house. He understood that in 1971, the primary reference ledger used by law enforcement was the physical photograph. By removing his face, he believed he had removed himself from the reach of the law. List vanished for 18 years, exploiting the old-world lack of digital oversight. He relocated to Denver, Colorado, adopting the alias of Robert Bob Clark. He did not change his nature. He simply resumed his rigid life as an accountant and remarried. He relied entirely on the fact that no contemporary images of John List existed in the public record. For nearly two decades, John List ceased to exist, replaced by a man who looked like a standard middle-aged professional. In 1989, the investigation underwent a technical pivot. Forensic artist Frank Bender collaborated with a forensic psychologist to conduct a high-resolution audit of List's face. Bender didn't just guess what List might look like. He used forensic anthropology to predict physiological changes over an 18-year gap. He modeled the loss of tissue elasticity, predicting the specific sagging of the jawline and the deepening of the nasolabial folds. He factored in male pattern baldness based on genetic probability. Most importantly, he applied psychological profiling. Bender theorized that a rigid, type A personality like List would not change his aesthetic. He chose a specific pair of thick-rimmed, authoritative glasses, believing List would still want to project an image of clinical, clerical superiority. The Age Progress bust was featured on America's Most Wanted in May 1989. A former neighbor in Colorado recognized the sculpture immediately as Bob Clark. On June 1, 1989, investigators arrested List at his accounting firm in Richmond, Virginia. While List initially denied his identity, the laboratory provided the final word. His identity was confirmed via fingerprint comparison, the one biological ledger he could not cut out of a photograph or suppress with a thermostat. Despite his 18-year head start, the audit of truth caught up with him. List was convicted in 1990, proving that even the most meticulous boogeyman cannot outrun the persistent resolution of forensic science. The Tent Girl case serves as the bridge between physical archives and digital connectivity. It demonstrates how a case moves from total hibernation into a high-resolution audit, not through a breakthrough in a sterile environment, but through the restoration of identity. It proves that as long as the biological ledger, the bone and the teeth is preserved, The truth remains accessible to future technology. On May 17, 1968, Wilbur Riddle discovered the remains of a young woman wrapped in a heavy canvas tarp in a ditch near Georgetown, Kentucky. The investigation stalled immediately, entering a period of administrative silence. In 1968, forensic resources were local and manually indexed. Without a witness, the victim was assigned a placeholder in the administrative record. The physical ledger provided only basic data. Anthropologists determined the victim was a white female, aged 16 to 22. There was, however, a specific marker in the evidence, a unique dental profile featuring a prominent gap and a missing tooth. In a modern environment, this would be an instantly searchable biometric marker. In 1968, without a centralized database, this biological key remained unsearchable and silent for 30 years. The shift from a stalled file to a resolution occurred in the late 1990s, marking the transition from paper-bound archives to the digital ledger. Wilbur Riddle, who had been haunted by the discovery, utilized early internet technology to post the case details on a personal web page. He posted the technical specifics, the green canvas, and the description of the dental work. In 1997, Rosemary Nickerson, who had been conducting a manual search for her missing sister for 30 years, encountered the post. The digital description of the teeth matched her sister's dental history. The internet acted as the connectivity bridge that the 1960s lacked. In 1998, the case moved into a formal audit, beginning with a legal exhumation. Forensic odontology was the primary tool for verification. Tooth enamel is the hardest substance in the human body. It survives environmental degradation that often destroys DNA. Specialists compared the skeletal remains directly against 30-year-old dental records. The dental match was perfect, efficiently identifying the victim as Barbara Hackman Taylor. Once the name was restored, the perpetrator's false narrative was exposed. The investigation shifted to Barbara's husband, George Earl Taylor. For decades, he had maintained a false narrative, telling their children and family that Barbara had simply abandoned them for another man. He used the lack of jurisdictional connectivity to hide a murder behind a lie of desertion. The audit revealed that George Taylor had died of cancer in 1987. While he outlasted the legal system by dying 11 years before the identification, he could not outlast the persistence of truth. The science of odontology dismantled his narrative. The Tent Girl case proves that the best tools aren't always sequencers. Sometimes the best tool is the connectivity of the human network. While the killer escaped the gavel, the digital audit provided mercy to a family living in a historical glitch. The biological ledger was balanced, and Barbara Hackman Taylor was given her name back. Next, the Inez Tulk case serves as the definitive laboratory example of the mechanical ledger. It illustrates a fundamental principle of forensic persistence. While biological evidence can degrade, the physics of a firearm barrel acts as a permanent record. This case proves that a suspect who retains the weapon used in a crime is holding a physical link to the event, waiting for technology to read the signature. In 1981, Inez K. Tulk was killed inside her Wichita, Kansas home. The investigation stalled immediately. There were no eyewitnesses, no forced entry, and no biological material suitable for 1980s testing protocols. James Onishenko, who lived two doors away, was interviewed during the initial canvas. He passed the screening because investigators lacked the evidence to dispute his alibi. The only evidence recovered was two 22 caliber bullets. In 1981, these were codes without a key. Without a national database to match specific tool marks, the bullets remained unsearchable unless the weapon was already in custody. The transition to a high-resolution audit occurred 20 years later through the National Integrated Ballistics Information Network, or NIBIN. The technical breakthrough relies on the Integrated Ballistic Identification System, known as IBIS. A gun barrel is not a smooth tube. It's a unique tool with microscopic imperfections created during manufacturing and wear. As a bullet travels through the barrel, the rifling causes unique microscopic scratches called striations into the jacket. In 2001, technicians utilized IBIS to perform a 3D topographical scan of the 1981 bullets, turning the surface into a digital map. In the late 1990s, Onishenko's handgun was seized during an unrelated domestic disturbance. Per modern protocol, the weapon was test fired and the results were entered into NIBIN. The system flagged a mathematical match between the digital map of Onishenko's weapon and the evidence recovered from the Tulsa crime scene 2 decades prior. This match was made possible by mechanical persistence. Unlike DNA, the steel of a firearm barrel is durable. The signature Onishenko's gun left in 1981 remained virtually identical in 2001. The tool marks had not changed. Only the laboratory's ability to search them had evolved. The audit concluded in 2003. The prosecution presented a three-point reality. Onishenko lived 100 feet from the victim. He owned the weapon at the time of the crime, and IBIS audit proved his weapon fired the fatal shots. 22 years after the murder, James Onishenko was convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison. The Inez Tolt case demonstrates that the lab relies on the persistence of data. Onishenko believed the passage of time had sanitized the crime, but the truth was etched in steel. The mechanical audit proved that time does not degrade the signature of a tool. This case proves that a suspect who retains the weapon used in a crime is effectively holding a physical link to the event, waiting for the technology to catch up and read the signature. As the investigative process evolves, we see a shift in who is performing the work. We are entering into an era where the science of solving a murder is often a struggle against administrative fragmentation. This is the era of the armchair detective, individuals who apply rigorous logic to public records to bridge the gap between agencies that fail to communicate. The Linda Pagano case is a definitive example of a historical glitch. It proves that the coldness of a case is often not due to a lack of evidence, but a failure to audit the information already in the ledger. On September 1, 1974, three children were playing in a park in Strongsville, Ohio, and they discovered skeletal remains. The victim had been killed by a close-range gunshot to the head. Because the discovery happened in Cuyahoga County, but the victim, 17-year-old Linda Pagano, had gone missing from Akron in Summit County, the investigation stalled immediately. This case was a total systemic failure. Linda's brother had reported her missing in 1974, providing descriptions that should have triggered an immediate match. However, because the discovery and the report were separated by a county line, the two files never touched. For over 40 years, Linda Pagano was buried in a potter's field as a Jane Doe, while her brother's report sat in a filing cabinet just miles away. The resolution did not begin with a police file, but with a mechanical failure in a cemetery's record keeping. Christina Gates, a genealogy researcher, was looking through the records of the Cuyahoga County Line Cemetery, trying to ro locate the grave of a family member. During her search, she identified a significant administrative glitch. A burial permit existed for a 1974 Jane Doe, but the cemetery's internal maps and ledgers failed to show where the body was actually located. This specific discrepancy, person documented as buried but physically missing from the map, became the catalyst for her audit. Prompted by this discrepancy, Gates began conducting genealogical research and utilized the Web Sleuth online community to identify who this missing Jane Doe could be. This led her to the Namus database, where she cross-referenced the 1974 burial date with missing person reports from the same year. He spotted the report for Linda Pagano and realized the height, location, and timeline were a logical match. Skates solved the administrative error by flagging the match for the authorities and forcing them to compare the two files. Only after Skates provided the logical link in 2016 did the formal scientific verification begin. This required the state to locate the remains and perform an extraction. In 2018, investigators used mitochondrial DNA testing, a tool for highly degraded samples, to compare the remains to a DNA sample provided by Linda's brother. The results were 100% match. The science verified the connection that the cemetery audit had uncovered. In July 2018, the Strongsville Jane Doe was officially restored to her identity as Linda Pagano. The audit revealed a painful reality. The match could have been made in 1974 if the two police departments had simply shared their investigations. The overdue identification allowed her brother to finally bring her home. However, the primary suspect, Byron Moore, had already been dead for over a decade, having passed away in 2003. He effectively outran the science. While the identification provided administrative mercy for the family, the perpetrator was no longer within reach of the law. The Linda Pagano case demonstrates that the most powerful tool in the science of murder is often a meticulous audit. The truth was not hidden in a complex DNA strand, but in a burial ledger that didn't add up. By reconciling the cemetery records with a 1974 missing person report, Skates proved that administrative persistence is often the final key to justice. The Mary Schlace case is a landmark in the history of molecular persistence. It represents one of the longest gaps between a crime and a resolution in American history. A 50-year silence that was finally broken by the most advanced iteration of investigative genetic genealogy. It proves that the passage of time does not erase the biological record. It merely places it in a state of hibernation until the laboratory develops the sensitivity to read the data. On February 15th, 1974, Mary Schles, a 25-year-old honors graduate, was murdered while hitchhiking from Minneapolis to Chicago. Within 3 hours, an eyewitness observed a suspect dumping her body from a compact car in a rural ditch in Dunn County, Wisconsin. Despite a timely recovery and an eyewitness description, the clerical reality of 1974 provided no path forward. The perpetrator vanished into a world lacking digital surveillance and biometric tracking. The investigation entered a state of administrative stall that lasted 5 decades. For half a century, the investigation was stalled by evidence that functioned as a useless ledger, given the technology of the era. The primary piece of physical evidence was a blue and orange stocking cap recovered at the scene. In 1974, the laboratory was limited to microscopic hair comparison, a technique now recognized as having high subjectivity and low evidentiary weight. Furthermore, a photograph found in the victim's apartment fueled decades of speculation and red herring leads. This illustrates how human bias can misdirect an audit when physical evidence cannot be quantified. Without a clinical data point to ground the investigation, the case remained a collection of theories rather than a pursuit of facts. The case transitioned into the modern genomic era in the late 2024. Forensic technicians performed a high-resolution audit on the fibers of the 50-year-old stocking cap. Using advanced extraction techniques, they were able to recover a partial DNA profile, a microscopic ledger that had remained intact in an evidence locker since the Nixon administration. The genealogical mapping conducted by the Ramapo College IgG Center encountered a significant glitch. Biological lineage failed to align with traditional birth and marriage records. Investigators eventually identified an undisclosed adoption in the family tree. Once the genealogical ledger was corrected to account for this non-biological branch, the data rerouted and pointed directly to a specific lineage in Minnesota. In November 2024, the audit reached its conclusion. Investigators identified John Keith Miller, an 84-year-old resident of Owatonna, Minnesota. When confronted with the undeniable reality of the DNA evidence recovered from the app, Miller provided a full confession. He admitted to the pickup and subsequent murder of Mary Schles, providing the closure that had been missing for 50 years. Miller entered, excuse me. Miller entered the legal system in early 2025. His confession, triggered by the laboratory's findings, finally moved Mary Schley's file from a historical record to a closed case. The Mary Schley's case proves that there is no expiration date on a biological signature. The lab treats a 50-year-old fiber with the same clinical gravity as a fresh sample, remaining the steward of the evidence until technology is capable of reading it, ensuring that the truth can be discovered regardless of how many decades have passed. The cases analyzed in this forensic architecture prove a singular, inescapable truth. The boogeyman is an entity that only thrives in the gaps of our technology. Whether a perpetrator attempts to hide behind the environmental manipulation of a cold room, the administrative shield of a clean record, or the literal erasure of their face from a photograph, they are always leaving a trail. They are constantly writing into a biological ledger that they lack the tools to read or destroy. As we move deeper into the 21st century, the laboratory's role has shifted from mere observation to a high-resolution audit of history itself. We've moved beyond the lone scientist and into the sentinel network, where every advance in genomic resolution and digital connectivity narrows the window for the phantom to operate. We treat the evidence, the 30-year-old DNA extract, the microscopic striations on a bullet, or the unique dental gap, not as a relic, but as microscopic witnesses that they're finally being allowed to speak. The ultimate sentence delivered by the laboratory is not always a gavel hitting a bench. It is the reconciliation of history. By restoring a name to a John Doe or identifying a killer who thought they had outrun the clock, we are performing an act of historical correction. We are ensuring that the record reflects reality, stripping the power away from the myth and replacing the boogeyman with a data profile. In this sanctuary of accountability, time does not degrade the truth. It only waits for us to develop the best tools to find it. This is our professional mandate and our ethical core, to ensure that no story is left told in standard definition when we have the capacity to provide 4K resolution. The audit continues, and as long as the evidence exists, the truth is persistent. Next week, we're moving the audit from the administrative files to the field. We'll be discussing the body farm. We're going to look at the transition from theoretical decay to the high-resolution study of taphonomy. We'll break down how the laboratory expanded into the outdoors to study the postmortem interval in real time, turning the decomposition process into a quantifiable data set, and what that means for the administrative and investigative record. If you haven't already, please like and subscribe to The Science of Murder to continue learning along with me. If you found today's deep dive into the investigation of cold cases fascinating, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred provider. Reviews help other science-minded true crime fans find the show, so I encourage you to tell your accomplices, friends, to learn along with us. I'd love to hear your thoughts on these cases or any future topics you'd like to suggest. You can find me on Instagram or Patreon as Science of Murder, or reach me directly at scienceofmurder@gmail.com. Stay curious, stay scientific, and join us in our next episode.